Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Dr. Mary's Monkey. Now, this is quite a case. We get into how the unsolved murder of a doctor, a secret laboratory in New Orleans, and cancer-causing monkey viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and the emerging global epidemics. So it's quite a mouthful here, but this is quite a book. So welcome to the show, Edward T. Haslam.
Thank you very much, Alan.
So Edward, let's get into the book. Tell us and tell the listeners kind of what the book is focused on. What's it about?
There's something called Family Jewels Number One. Okay, that I need to introduce at this point. The CIA. This is the CIA's name for a document that they produced, okay? The CIA called it CIA Family Jewels, all right? What happened around the time of the Watergate thing, the CIA director shot off his mouth about something and didn't know what he was talking about because he was a political appointee and didn't really know what had been going on in the basement for the last 15 years. And his director of security said, you know, boss, if you say the wrong thing like this, you could go to jail for it. You need to know what was going on in the basement, okay? So the CIA director of security produced an eyes-only memo. Only three people in the CIA were even allowed to read this thing. And it had eight things that the CIA did that was either illegal or embarrassing to the agency, okay? When the month my book was released in 2007, CIA Director Michael Hayden called a press conference and said, time to open the kimono. We're going to tell you what was in the family jewels. Here are the documents. There are eight family jewels. You can read number 2 through 8 with minor redactions. However, there is something that happened between 1958 and 1964 that the CIA was involved in, and we are not willing to tell you a single word about. Family Jewel number one remains 100% redacted, even though it happened over 50 years ago. And what I think is in there is the fact that the CIA's money laundering operation was used to set up this laboratory in New Orleans, because the guy that set it up said the rest of this stuff, you know, things were usually on like a mortgage, you know, payments over a number of years and so many dollars a month and everything else. He said this particular project, the money came in within about a week from six different banks, all with odd, that had nothing to do with each other, all with odd amounts of money that added up to whatever they needed to build the facility. That's money laundering, okay? And the only people that were in a situation to do that at that point in time, frankly, were the CIA under Nixon's directions. Okay, so you've got really powerful people here, and you've got stuff that nobody wants to... I mean, you say, well, why'd you guys do that? Well, because they mass-inoculated the American people with a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine. You know, that's the secret nobody wants out.
Well, okay, so now how do we get Lee Harvey Oswald involved in this and tied to this?
Okay. Well, when they decide to weaponize the virus, they go underground with it into safe house level laboratories. And what they need, the resource they need, is someone who's been trained to work with cancer-causing viruses, because they're very dangerous to work with, you know, to stand there and kill the mice with, you know, chloroform or whatever.
Right.
Cut the mice open, do an autopsy on them, or a dissection, I guess is a better term, on the mice. Remove the tumors that are in the mice, because the mice have been injected with this cancer-causing virus, and they're loaded with tumors. We're looking for big tumors, aggressive ones, okay? And you drop these into a blender and put a cap on it, and you blend them up into a sauce, and then you start putting that into test tubes and making flies out of it and keeping the notes on what you've done. And that has to happen somewhere, and somebody's got to do that. You've got to get somebody who's been trained to do that doing it for you, okay? Now, it just so happens that Altnauschner happens to know this young gal down in Florida, who at the that moment is going to the University of Florida. She is actually from Bradenton originally, and there's quite a bit of newspaper articles and paper trail on her when she was in Bradenton, because when she was in high school, she was doing her own cancer experiments to prove that cigarette smoking caused cancer, which was like Altnauschner's favorite subject, right? And she starts giving cancer to mice in 7 days. Okay, well, that's faster than they're able to do it at the National Cancer Institute. And she goes and the American Cancer Society is holding their annual national press briefing in St. Petersburg, which is right up the road from Bradenton. And she goes and crashes that meeting with her notes. And as they're about to kick her out, somebody says, well, wait a second, who is this woman? Why is she doing this? You know? And she says, well, I'm doing this research, and I've found something that's important, and you guys need to know about it. So they wind up going back to her laboratory and checking it out. And she is, in fact, doing what she said she was doing. She's outperforming NCI in a dirt floor laboratory in a high school with no budget and no security, okay? So they shut down her laboratory immediately and say, but you're coming with us. And they take her up to Buffalo, New York, to the Roswell Park Memorial Cancer Institute, and train her. She works in Dr. Moore's lab. Dr. Moore's the director, and they train her how to use cancer-causing viruses and to work with them and stuff, because these guys all know about the contamination of the polio vaccine, all right? Then they get her into the University of Florida, okay? She's a sophomore at the University of Florida. This is the gal that has proven that she's willing to stand there at a laboratory bench, kill the mice, cut them open, and do the dissections, Okay? She has experience doing this, and she's been trained to do it by professionals so that she won't kill herself and everybody around her while she's doing it. So Ochsner calls her up at the University of Florida and says, Judy, she's a sophomore at this point, how would you like to skip the last 2 years of college and start medical school in the fall? We'll pay. Okay?
Yeah.
We'll, no tuition. We'll give you a stipend. We'll let you in the advanced admission program, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, of course Judy wants to do it. Her dream is to find the cure for cancer. Okay, so she is recruited by Alton Ochsner to come to New Orleans to do this. Now, she gets there. She's early for some reasons. That are, they're in the book, and in her book, she's got a very nice book called Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, which I wrote the foreword to and is actually published by my publisher, Tryon Day. That tells her story in more detail, but I have three chapters on her and Lee in Dr. Mary's Monkey, which is the book we're talking about here. And so this is all set up for her to come into town, right? But she gets there early and she starts shooting off her mouth about she's in town to work for Ochsner and for Mary Sherman and she's a great cancer researcher and all this other stuff, right? They have somebody that they need to get in there fast to get a hold of her, to get her to her, where she's supposed to be living, to get her to her cover job, to get her set up in this secret laboratory so that they can do all this stuff. They have a Marine with intelligence training who is from New Orleans, who's got one foot in the mob and one foot in the CIA, and they send in Lee Harvey Oswald to be her handler. All right? He is Judith Very Baker's handler. And within, he meets her like on a Friday, okay?
Yeah.
The next day, he introduces her to David Ferry, in whose apartment they're going to be doing this research. The next day, there's a party at David Ferry's apartment where they produce Dr. Mary Sherman so she can see that Sherman is actually part of this loop. Then what happens is Judy's getting very suspicious that, I mean, this all doesn't look like real government stuff. So she says, I need some proof that this is a real government operation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Oswald says, okay, I'll take you down to meet Mr. Bannister. So he takes her down to Guy Bannister's office. Now, Bannister was the head of the FBI in Chicago, right? He's got all these things on the wall, and, you know, he can prove he's a big government guy, okay? And he says, yes, Lee is working with us on a Get Castro project, okay? So this has all got some kind of blessing. Then Ochsner had told her, I'll meet you the second week of May. So on May 8th, that's the first day of the second week of May, right? There's a meeting set up in Charity Hospital for Judy to go in and talk to Dr. Ochsner about this project. And who arranges the meeting? It's Lee Oswald. Because Bannister's, I mean, Lee Oswald hadn't been in town for 10 years. Except for a couple of days when he passed through on the way to the Soviet Union. How does he fall into all of this information and these people and this operation? It's because it's all been set up by Bannister, and he is the coordinator in it. And so he is, gets Judy her apartment, gets her set up in her cover job. And in her cover job, she is working at the Riley Coffee Company. Lee Oswald is working at the Riley Coffee Company. They start on the same day. They are referred by the same employment agency. And they both are working with a ex-FBI agent by the name of Bill Moynihan. Okay? Now, the drill is this. These guys go in there, act like normal employees, so the rest of the employees don't even have any idea what they're up to. Early in the week, they take care of their week's work, and then, come middle of the week, they start disappearing around lunchtime. Where are they going? They're going over to David Ferry's apartment. They go into his kitchen, and they start pulling out laboratory equipment from the cabinets. They convert his kitchen into a laboratory. Then, the mice are being housed at a building across the street, which we call the Mouse House. Garrison actually discovered this. They had 2,000 mice in cages over there. Mm-hmm. Well, the Cuban guys that are over there take about 50 of the mice, put them in a cardboard box, bring them over to David Ferry's house, and Judy and Lee stand there and kill the mice and cut them up and do all the stuff I was saying about the test tubes. And then Judy throws it all in a lunchbox, gets on a city bus, and goes up to St. Charles Avenue, where she has a key to Mary Sherman's apartment. And she lets herself in, deposits the lunchbox that's run reads for a while, and then goes back to the Riley Coffee Company so she can clock Lee Oswald out on time. Okay? And Judy's initials are on Lee Oswald's time cards. Now, these time cards did not make it into the 24, 26, whatever the number is, Warren Commission volumes. Jack Ruby's mother's dental records did, but Lee Oswald's time cards didn't. Why not? Because any reasonable investigator would have said, who is approving Lee Oswald's time cards? And it was Moynihan, normally, but when Moynihan wasn't around, Moynihan's secretary was approving it, and Judy was Moynihan's secretary, and her initials are very clearly on Lee Oswald's time cards. So if Oswald gets in there because of Judy and because they have the CIA, and this is all part of Operation Mongoose, has decided to weaponize these cancer viruses to produce a injectable biological weapon that they can use to kill not only people like Fidel Castro, but also inconvenient witnesses and people like Jack Ruby, who are in jail, okay? And as the summer goes on, they kill thousands of mice, all right? And then they start testing it on monkeys, and at first South American monkeys, and then African monkeys, which are more expensive. And then they're finally at the point, the question is, well, this works on monkeys, okay? Does it work on humans? Where can we get some humans that we can test this on with the intention of killing them to see if it actually works and nobody will get upset about this? Where do we find these people? Well, how about death row at Angola Penitentiary in southeast Louisiana, which happens to be right down the road from Jackson, Louisiana, not Jackson, Mississippi, Jackson, Louisiana, where they have a hospital for the criminally insane, and they can lock these people up in and test it in there. And this happens to be in what's called East Feliciana Parish in southeast Louisiana, which is outside of Baton Rouge. But the county seat, as it's known in most places, is in a place called Clinton, right, which is about 10 miles from Jackson. And it is on August 29th, 1963, is when Lee Oswald is seen in Clinton, Louisiana, with Clay Shaw, okay, who's driving a black Cadillac. Now, the backstory on this is they didn't want Shaw's driving them up to this mental hospital. Why? Well, he's a big, dignified-looking guy. He's got this big black Cadillac, and they're going to rendezvous with the van that's coming over from Angola Penitentiary on the highway. And so they show up at the front door, the front gate. I mean, this is a hospital for the criminally insane, right? They have fences and guards and guns and stuff like that, okay? They show up at the front gate with the state van in front and the black Cadillac in behind. And they even pick up an employee from the hospital who's sitting in the black Cadillac. All right, so they all get waved in together. Why are they doing this? So that they can go inject the patient with the bioweapon to see if it works. Now, they didn't want to wait in Jackson, Louisiana, because that would attract attention. So they drive over to Clinton. Now, this is late August in Louisiana. It is hot in late August in Louisiana. And it is now the middle of the afternoon, and they drive in front of the courthouse. They are expecting an empty plaza in front of the courthouse. But what they didn't realize was that the day before, which was August 28th, 1963, Martin Luther King gave a speech. And because of that, the Congress on Racial Equality had scheduled black voter registration drives all across the South. So they drive into this square expecting it to be empty, and there is this scene, the civil rights scene going on, where the blacks are all standing in line trying to register to vote on one side, and the whites are standing around in the shade with their arms crossed on the other side, and this poor guy in the middle with a badge, John Manchester, the town sheriff or marshal, is hoping there's not going to be trouble. Now, into the scene drives this black Cadillac, right? And Manchester looks at the, who are these, outside agitators, media, whatever? So he goes over, pulls his badge to the driver and says, may I see your ID, please? And the guy takes out his driver's license and says, I am Clay Shaw of the International Trademark. Okay? So this guy knows who's driving the car. All right? We know this because he goes up to Washington, D.C. during the House Select Committee on Assassinations hearings, and he gives this information to Congress. But they stamp it secret, and they don't want us, the people, to know about it. So for the next 16 years, this thing I'm telling you is secret, okay? And we know about it today because the Oliver Stone movie forced the JFK Records Act, and it got released, okay? Now, what happens next is, there's two other people in the car, actually two or three other people. One of them is this strange-looking guy with an orange wig and grease-paint eyebrows, who everybody recognizes as David Ferry. That's not hard. And then this young white guy gets out of the car, and he makes a bet to see if he can go over and register to vote because he's white. And he gets, he doesn't even live in the area, right? So he gets in line with the blacks. And while they're killing time there, they're waiting for the payphone to ring, all right? From the, penitentiary saying, we're leaving now, go to our rendezvous point. Okay, so Oswald goes over there, and he goes and signs in the guest register, in the logbook, or, who are you? I'm the Harvey Oswald. Here's my signature. And he gives them his ID, and they say, well, you don't live here. You can't vote here. And and he goes back and gets in the car, okay? So we know Oswald got out of that car because he went and signed in to see if he could register to vote, okay? He's leaving a breadcrumb trail at this point, okay? This is a month after he started leaving his breadcrumb trail because he's known since late July that they're setting him up to be the patsy in assassination, okay? And he tells Judy this in late July. So all this is happening up there, and then they get into the mental hospital, and they inject these guys, and Judy's not with him at this point, all right? It's Ferry and Oswald and Clay Shaw, and they drive back. Now, this hospital is 4 hours north of New Orleans, 3.5-4 hours. Okay, it is not in a suburb. All right, it's 4 hours of highway driving. Okay, so you drive up there, you got a couple hours there, and you drive back. You just spent 10, 11, 12 hours doing this. This is a full day project. All right. Now what they need to know is, does this work? Will this guy get cancer? And there's a special test, and there's a handful of people in the country that know how to do it, and one of them is Judith Ferry Baker. Why does she know? Because she was trained up at the Roswell Park Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York, how to do this test. Okay? So she needs to get back up to this hospital, all right? And they have Lee Oswald drive her up in this old beat-up green car called a Kaiser, and he drives all the way up there and takes her over. She's wearing a nurse's uniform, takes her over to the hospital, the mental hospital up there, so she can go in and do the test to see if the cancer has kicked in, which it has, okay? At this point in time, she realizes that, hey, these people are using me as an asset to murder people. And she bolts, all right? And at that point, she gets kicked out of New Orleans. Ochsner is furious at her and kicks her out of New Orleans. This is all told in Me and Lee very clearly. And so what happens now is Oswald has nothing to do except wait to see if it's...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This weapon works, and if it does, his job is to take it to Mexico City so they can try to get it into Cuba to kill Castro. And so for the month of September, Judy's gone. Oswald sits around. He doesn't do any leafleting. He doesn't do any political stuff. He sits around on his front porch reading because he's waiting for the orders to go to Mexico City. And he hadn't worked in about 6 weeks, maybe 9 weeks at this point in time. Has no money, but somehow he's able to get on a bus and go to Mexico City and pay for hotel rooms and everything else. Somebody is financing Oswald at this point, and it's very clearly at this point that we now know it's CIA. And so that is how, to answer your question, how does Oswald get involved in the middle of this? And, you know, and then there's this other issue is that we seem to have a number of epidemics going on, some involving cancer and some involving monkey viruses, and one of which is AIDS. And so the logical question is, how many of these things are actually connected at this juncture, all of which started out with this murder of my father's friend,
right?
Okay? And I wanted to know what happened. And what I was able to do was I was able to go to the library of all places and get the police reports and the autopsy reports and all this stuff. And so I actually, and all the newspaper coverage, All right? And so I had hard, real documents from the authorities that I was able to go through. And I got out on my kitchen table and I made a stack of the official things and a stack of the media. And when I read through them, it was then I realized that there was nothing in the media about Mary Sherman's arm being missing. Okay? And it was later on I got the photos and put them in the updated edition of the book. I'll look for the word crime scene photos, the words crime scene photos at the bottom of the cover. And, you know, one of the really interesting things, I mean, how high does this go, you know? As I was going through the media things, the newspaper articles, I was just telling you about, you know, I was noticing all the other stories that were on these pages. And one of the stories that appears was that it appears on Wednesday, right, which is July 22nd, 1964. On Mary's body is found on July 21st, on Tuesday in the morning, okay?
Yeah.
The story that appears on Wednesday says, yesterday, President Johnson suddenly jumped in his limousine and drove to the Pentagon for an unannounced visit. When he came out, he had his driver take him to Arlington National Cemetery, where he stood at Jack Kennedy's grave for the first time. Something happened that day.
Huh.
I find it to be an interesting connection. You know,
yeah.
Did they have to brief Johnson on what happened in New Orleans on this murder so that Johnson could tell J. Edgar Hoover, do not investigate this? And what amuses me on the dark side of my personality is that J. Edgar Hoover tells his agents not to investigate this on the grounds of jurisdiction. All right? He says this is an NOPD jurisdictional matter. But if I'm right, and Mary Sherman was electrocuted at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, that's federal property, and that is FBI jurisdiction. And the whole point of relocating her from the Public Health Service Hospital back to her apartment and faking the murder scene was to get it off of federal property and out of FBI jurisdiction.
So they chose to kill Dr. Sherman. Did they not also want to kill Judith Baker?
First of all, Judith Baker left New Orleans almost a year earlier and had gone back to Florida and had been told that if she opened her mouth, she'd be killed. So she's basically in hiding. Okay. Were they trying to kill Mary Sherman, or were they trying to kill Dr. Alton Ochsner, or were they just trying to kill whoever turned on the particle accelerator? Okay?
Yeah.
We don't know. All right? One of the things, again, you can tell by this interview, there's a lot of moving parts in here, okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And this is all very carefully explained in my book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. But one of the things is, where was Mary Sherman for the 2 weeks before she died? All right?
Yeah.
She was in Boston. Well, if you know Boston is where they make the linear particle accelerators, then you can say, well, gee, maybe Mary was up there because she was being trained how to operate the linear particle accelerator. Because they no longer had their other guy that was part of the original team there, who was the linear particle accelerator operator out of Princeton. Okay? So somebody else had to operate it. If Alton Ochsner himself had grabbed that handle and blown off his arm, they would not have been able to drag him back to his house and call it a sex slashing, which is what they did to Mary Sherman. They got away with that because she was a widow with no family, and once the people found out about the dimensions of the murder, you know, everybody wants to take three steps back, you know.
Now, I was going to say, do you attribute the cancer death of Jack Ruby to something that someone did to him?
Yes, they locked him in a room with an x-ray machine for half an hour and to lower his immune system. And then somebody injected him with something, and he passed the note to the guard and said, they have injected me with cancer. We have a time frame on Jack Ruby's death from when he was first shown to have cancer. First of all, he had a doctor who said he was in fine health. You know, he was kind of a physical fitness nut and everything else. He was in fine health. That doctor, whose name, I think it's Doc or something, he's an Oriental guy, was transferred out of this, and this guy, Joey West, was brought in, who's basically a CIA doctor. And 28 days later, Ruby dies. Well, it happens to be 28 days. You remember the guy up at the mental hospital, and Oswald's waiting for him to die? 28 days later, he dies, right? That's how long it takes the cancer to kill people, right? And Ruby is sitting there in jail waiting for a retrial outside of Dallas. You know, and Ruby's asked Earl Warren, said, can you guys get me out of here? I'm not safe here in Dallas. They're going to kill me, you know? At any rate, so was Ruby assassinated with this biological weapon? My opinion is yes.
Wow. So now, they were never able to get this to Castro or get him by this means at all. Do you think they tried, actually?
Well, first of all, I think the Castros found out about it, and the Cubans had very good intelligence, particularly in places like New Orleans. And there were efforts to get doctors in Cuba to cooperate with this in terms of getting Castro there. And there's some of the stuff that's come out recently through the files, JFK files being released, show more of the detail about what happened in Mexico City and how Oswald was trying to hand off what he thought was the biological weapon. I think he actually got swindled out of it on his way to Mexico City by some people in Texas, but they were trying to get it in there. I think the whole thing is a harebrained scheme in the first place, but when you're dealing with those kind of people, you feed them this BS and try to get them to believe it, so they'll keep doing the work. But what they wound up with in Texas was the bioweapon that they could inject into Ruby, you know, to keep Ruby from talking. Because one of the things Ruby was doing, Ruby was really tight with Carlos Marcello, all right, the mob boss in New Orleans.
Right.
And he was running the money for this secret laboratory from the people in Dallas down to New Orleans. Okay, he was part of the financing of it, and he knew all about it. Okay, so when Ruby said, I've been injected with cancer, you know, he knew what he was talking about. And you know, he's a nightclub owner, what is he, you know. Ruby was part of the operation and was a gun runner and stuff, you know.
Wow. Now, you mentioned earlier that Oswald and Baker kind of thought that he was becoming a patsy. Did he know that the assassination was going to happen?
He was infiltrating the plot. And he got to a point where and this is late July, where he said, I've seen too many faces, and I'm the only person around here that's expendable. And they have asked me to do a bunch of stuff in August, which he later does, which will make me look like a communist. Okay? The Fair Play for Cuba things. And so he says, if I'm being set up to look like a communist, and they're planning on killing Kennedy, and I've seen all the faces, then who's the logical guy that they're going to set up as the patsy? It's going to be me. You know, I mean, that's what Lee says, I think it's July 29th, to Judith. And one of the things that happens, that within a couple of days of that, Lee, you know, the Ferry's got airplanes, right? And Hugh Ward, who's Bannister's partner, has got, and these planes are owned by people like Schlumberger and stuff, right? But they've got 1,000-mile ranges on them, twin-engine planes, all right? And Lee goes out to the airport and gets on one of these planes, and they fly up to Knoxville, Tennessee. And now you can't get from New Orleans to Knoxville, Tennessee by car and back in 24 hours, right? But you can do it in a twin-engine airplane, right? So Lee goes up there, does something in Knoxville, and comes back and is ready to go to Mobile, where he makes a presentation at a Jesuit seminary about life in the Soviet Union. It's all documented, okay? So what we've got here is we've got this little window where we know Oswald went to the airport, got on a plane, went somewhere, and came back. We also find that in Knoxville, Tennessee, at the Atomic Energy Museum, Lee Oswald signs the guest register. Lee H. Oswald. Pay attention, FBI. He writes USSR behind his name, just so they don't miss it. Then, as his address, right? Where is he living? He lives in New Orleans. Address, Dallas Road, Dallas, Texas. Hey, guys. The road's going to Dallas. This is Lee Oswald. Remember your spy from the Soviet Union? Right? The road's going to Dallas. Right? He leaves that. That's one of his breadcrumbs that he leaves. At any rate, then he comes back and tells Judith, he says, they're setting me up. They've asked me to go start a fight on Canal Street. They've asked me to stand in front of the International Trademark and hand out leaflets in favor of supporting Castro. They've arranged for the television crews to come over and film me. They're going to have me on the radio talking about communism. They're setting me up to be a communist. Why? Because they need a communist to be the patsy.
Yeah. It'd certainly be easier to make him look bad as well. So how do you feel this has all affected us today?
I should be asking you that.
Yeah, well, you know, you're the professional. No, I mean, do you think that this has... like, because there's so many people that talk about the JFK assassination and Oswald and all of that sort of stuff. How has this affected the way we deal with politics and the way we deal with conspiracy?
Well, there's something called the Hamlet syndrome, you know, which is we all feel like our president was killed, you know, by the people that wanted power. And those people pretty much still have power today. And, you know, one of the things that happened fairly recently, okay, during the recent presidential election was this issue of Ted Cruz's father. In the photograph with Lee Oswald. Was that Ted Cruz's father? Yes, it was. You know, I researched it. I published it. I interviewed Judith, who was there. And Lee told her, that's Raffaello. He's here to protect me because he's a Cuban. And if any Cubans show up, he's got somebody. And you see in the pictures, Raffaello's not handing out any leaflets. He's just standing there eye on things, okay? And what people need to know is this guy was no transient Cuban. This guy was a graduate in petroleum engineering from the University of Texas who owned an oil exploration company located down the street from that place. And he had a history of being involved in Cuban political activities. And he was asked probably by Bannister to come over and help keep an eye on Lee so if somebody showed up, Lee didn't get beaten up on camera, you know, because Lee was concerned about that, you know, because Lee had been arrested the week before, August 9th, and was concerned that that situation was getting out of control, and he did not want to go back into jail. And one of the interesting things is, you know, so somebody called, Judy actually calls WDSU and says, there's somebody out here handing out leaflets about Castro. Get over here with the cameras. Well, these guys are all queued up. They're waiting for the phone call. And Lee does not want to be seen doing this any longer than necessary. So he's standing there when the cameras show up. He said, look, the cameras are here. I need to get to work. And so he starts handing out the leaflets while the cameras are rolling. The moment the cameras are finished, he's out of there. Right?
Yeah.
It's a totally fabricated situation for the media. And it is Ted Cruz's father. You know, I got photos of him before and afterwards and did side-by-sides and all that other stuff. It's obviously him.
Just amazing, amazing how it all ties together. So now, I guess you communicate with Judith Baker a lot still.
Well, I wouldn't say a lot, but you know, I have in the past. Certainly, when I was trying to figure out who she was, and I actually did the first round editing on her Me and Lee book. So I had to really get in. Up to my eyeballs in her story. I did a timeline on it, and I fact-checked it and everything else. And so when I was doing that, I certainly communicated a lot, particularly in the run-up to that, because I'm the one that took her book to my publisher and said, you know, would you consider publishing this? But anyway, I think she's got an important story to tell in Me and Lee. And my book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, what I was talking about here, part of it is in her book and part of it's in Dr. Mary's Monkey. But, you know, it's from a distance it sounds pretty strange, but you get into the book and you'll see it's documented like a master's thesis. I mean, I nailed down everything I could, and some of it is from my personal experience, you know. And so some of it is my eyewitness testimony, some of it's Judas' eyewitness testimony, and as many documents as we could find to support it all.
Yeah. So what do you think the best books besides yourself and Judith to read? Do you think there's any other what angle do you take in this whole JFK assassination to be the best?
Well, first of all, Oliver Stone's movie is a great place to start, just the movie itself, right? And that movie is based upon two books. The first book is Jim Garrison's On the Trail of the Assassins, because the movie is about Jim Garrison, I mean, and his prosecution of Clay Shaw. The other book that Stone used, just because it covered so much and had so much great information about Daily Plaza and stuff, was Crossfire by Jim Mars. And so I say, if you're new to the Kennedy assassination and you want to have the Bible of it from this side of the aisle, Crossfire is the place to start. And Jim Mars wrote the foreword to Dr. Mary's Monkey. And he wrote the afterword to Me and Lee. So I worked with him pretty closely on both of these things. And, you know, it's great having a world-class expert like Jim Mars looking over my shoulder. You know, and if I would have a question, I'd call him up, and he'd have all the Warren Commission volumes there on his shelf, and he's got them indexed, and he'd look it up and say, yeah, it says right here, blah, blah, blah. And and Jim has died.
Yeah.
Great loss to everybody. But I would say his book is really the place to start. Jim Garrison's book is excellent. I look at my book as kind of, I had no intention of getting into the Kennedy thing.
Yeah.
I entered it through the back door, but I was committed to follow the story wherever it led, and it just happened to lead there.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was 60 Minutes, the CBS News show, that brought Judith Ray Baker to me, because she kept telling them, there's this book, and I was in that laboratory, and I was the person doing that work, So they brought her to me, and it was, they spent 14 months and a lot of money investigating her story, which they would not have done if they had not taken it very seriously. And then the phone rang, and somebody upstairs shut it down.
Wow.
So her story never got on 60 Minutes. But it got to me, and I took it to Trine Day, and now her book, which is very well received on Amazon. You can look it up, Me and Lee. It's got like 525 reviews on it, 4.5 stars. People really, really like her book and thank her for telling her story. She's a whistleblower.
Yeah. Now, let's give out your website book information. Of course, your book can be found anywhere, and we'll have it linked on our website as well. Your website is actually drmarysmonkey.com, and you have to spell out the doctor. So D-O...
That's correct.
Right. And so we'll have that linked as well. Any other information for people, for listeners, to get a hold of you, or...?
No, that's pretty much it. There's about 14 hours of videos on the website, and there's links to other books, some of them I just mentioned. There are videos like interviewing people that are vaccine manufacturers, talking about the contamination of the polio vaccine. I mean, there's all this stuff that I've talked about. I've put as much of that as I could on the website, so... The landing page has got reader quotes. There's hundreds of them. And then you go into the website, and it's got all these links to this stuff. And then it's got the crime scene photos in there, which are pretty strong photos. If you're not ready to look at strong photos, don't go there. But if you want to know what we're talking about, that's where they are.
Yeah, for sure. Well, again, our guest has been Edward T. Haslam. And the book we're talking about was Dr. Mary's Monkey. Thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.